I think at the end of the day where we can get tripped up and we get in our own way and I can feel like, oh, maybe I'm not good enough for this, or maybe, you know, what have you, I come back to, I'm pretty proud of the person I am and who I look at in the mirror. And if I can just come back to being just me, like no one else, don't try to be the professor from Harvard that is speaking on the TED Talk. Like, that's not me. Don't try to be that person. Don't try to be, you know, the head coach when you are the captain of the water polo team. Come back to you. Like, man, we're given all these gifts and all of these abilities to do things. Why would I sleep on that? Like, to me, that would just bum me out to be living at 20% or 30%. Why not live at 100? And that is the same energy 100% that I try to return to everyone that I'm around.
Welcome back to Toxic Free with KB. I'm your host, KB, better known as Kate Middleton. This is the show where we help you reduce your everyday toxic exposure in life. So our next guest for the show today,
I'm so excited.
You know why? Because I got to wear medals. Not any medals, guys. Olympic medals. Our next guest today, Cami Craig. Cami serves as an executive and performance coach at Mindful Warrior. Cami specializes in training C-suite executives to excel in coordinating and disseminating information under intense pressure. Yeah, we could all use that. Her coaching expertise extends to helping leaders build confidence and masterful communication skills, especially in complex, ambiguous, and fast-paced environments. Cami's exceptional achievements as a 13-year veteran of the United States Women's National Water Polo Team, a three-time Olympian, and a two-time gold medalist enrich her passionate work as a performance coach. Cami's talents extend beyond coaching. A gifted public speaker, a leader, and Cami has also delivered many talks to corporate leaders in universities and youth athletes across the nation. As a proud first-generation college graduate and the sole athlete in her family, Cami's journey is an inspiring testament to her resilience and dedication. She currently resides in my little town that I live in California, so cannot wait to have her share more about just all those amazing accolades. Guys, we really jump into how having a learning disability does not stop you from thriving and how to overcome negative thoughts about them if you have one. How to create a disciplined routine. We could all use that on a daily basis. And how to transition out of past roles and reinvent your story and come back to home yourself. Let's jump in. It seems like I'm so outgoing and so, you know, engaging. People are like, oh my gosh, no, like you're such like a social butterfly. I'm like, no, I walk into my husband's office and I literally like start breaking out in a sweat. I'm like, oh my God, people are looking at me. And that's a whole another discussion. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. So excited
to have you here. I've been, you know, kind of waiting for this day since we met in the locker room.
Yep.
It's one of those funny conversations that we have, like, you know, when you see someone out on the street after you see them so much at the pool and you're like, it's nice to see you in clothes.
Yeah, no, exactly. And not in a bathing suit with a cap on. I've had a lot of great connections and relationships built on a pool deck, in a pool, or in a locker room. So this is no surprise to me that we connected via the pool. And seeing you every morning. And so it is great to actually be dressed and be sitting here and
yes.
to be sharing our stories. I'm excited.
I know, right? We have our face done. Anyways, but I just fell in love. Like, you know, we met and I was like, there's something about you that I want to get deeper beyond the surface level. Mm. And you were so just like a beautiful light. That came in and
was
like, what is your story? There's something deep within you. And you're like, I do water polo and this and that. So I just want to like hit it off and ask you, can you share your personal journey with us just a little bit?
Yeah.
And I want to go into further the details with the learning disability
yeah.
that you did share with me that I was like, oh my gosh, this is our connection.
Yes. Yes. So, I am the former center of the women's U.S. water polo team. I had the honor and pleasure of competing for the women's U.S. water polo team in the 2008, 12, and 16 Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. I now do executive performance coaching and work with a company called Mindful Warrior, helping organizations be impactful and build their teams. Mm-hmm. And I was born and raised in San Ynez, California, which is we're based in Santa Barbara here with the podcast, but just over the hill, and was diagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD in second grade. Mm. And school was an absolute challenge. It felt like a battlefield. Like I had to put on armor each day to get into the classroom and get what needed to get done. But I was really fortunate to have such a love and passion for sports because you can't play sports without getting the grades. So sports really mm-hmm. ended up being the motivator, being the release, and being the place where I got kind of my atta girls and got to build my confidence, where the classroom didn't really serve that purpose for me.
So second grade, all I remember about in second grade is that my teacher, Mrs. Atwood, it's your heart, like you're the best. My teacher would just make like king cake every Friday, and you know, with a little hidden baby in it, if you guys know anything about king cake. Anyways, that's beyond that. But second grade, what a pivotal developmental time in your life as
yes.
well. And I know you do have siblings, but when you're starting to advance, like even the brain chemistry of that and the association of kind of seeing yourself in the mirror
mm-hmm.
as a young child and starting to maybe develop a mind, a body, and think like, okay, why can't I focus? Or you probably might not even think this, but kids on the playground even saying things to you, mm-hmm. maybe teasing you like this and that. And something that when you bring in the topic of dyslexia,
mm-hmm.
something that I think about as myself as a child, and then I have another follow-up to that, is that when I was younger, I just remember my brain would mix up numbers so mm-hmm. easily. And when you think of dyslexia, or many people think of dyslexia, they think of just reading.
Mm-hmm.
But my dyslexia comes in number form and also certain pattern form.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yep.
Like agility purposes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I just remember that from a young age, I got so scared counting money
mm-hmm.
because I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't count back. My brain couldn't like interpret that.
Sure.
And every time I shared my phone number, I would mix numbers up.
Yeah.
That's why my phone number now has so many double digits in it. Not that I got
it. It was planned.
It was planned. Thank you, God. But those are some of those times, especially as a young child. Like, what type of words came to your head? Did you ever tell yourself, like, since we're on the topic of toxic free living,
mm-hmm.
man, my brain is toxic,
mm.
or I am dumb?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, it's really, I'll start with saying when I initially was diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia, they prescribed Adderall mm. for me. And so my mom went and got the prescription and she felt it was really important that I didn't start taking this medication and then being sent off to school. For her, it was really important to be able to provide that medication and then be able to watch me and see how it affected me, impacted me positively, negatively, but what was the actual lived experience? So I believe the medication came during a school year. She said, we'll wait till summer and see kind of how this works out. Summer came around and she looked at me, looked at the bottle, opened it up and poured the whole thing down the sink. She decided right then that, you know, we weren't going to go that route. Now medication.
Well, wait, yeah. Let me ask, can I interrupt?
Yeah.
Why did she, your mom being so in tune with that, what did she see in that medication and your kind of spirit?
Like, yeah.
What did she see happen during that time?
Well, I never took it. It was the thought that she would be changing, suppressing, or altering that spirit that you spoke of. And, you know, she shares like this thought of, I don't want to change you, but what we can do is adjust your schedule and kind of our living habits and practices to help support you with these learning differences. So medication went down the sink and
never took it
and started swimming every day, made sure I had outside time every day. And really, you know, she was a really great advocate and proponent of me learning how to, you know, time block and take breaks and have a clean space, you know, around me so that I could do homework and really knowing what it was to go outside, come back in, go, you know, change your position, have a glass of water, have a snack. And so I started learning all of these tools at a young age. And my mom was really good at helping me learn how to do that.
I one more personal story here. My stepson is 11 right now. Mm-hmm. And he just started water polo. He loves it. It's probably the only sport that he's been in that he actually enjoys to be a part of. But when you talked about changing up the routine, becoming kind of meticulously organized, I find that with his room compared to his siblings, his room, his drawers, everything has a divider. Mm. Shirts are all right.
Yeah.
We kind of set that up for him, but also just his bed over there, the way his toys are set up, you know, everything is ready to go. Reminding him, all right, this is your routine. You get home from school, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is how it goes, right? This is the routine, how he goes. Homework first. Playtime second, you know?
Yes.
So
that really resonates.
Yeah. I find that that helps him a lot. And when we go back to your childhood instance, did that just become a routine for you that you took on later in life?
Yes.
Or did you ever fight it? Like, did your brain ever fight it?
No, I think that's it. The way that your stepson is operating right now was very much how I operated at that age and even younger. So I found, you know, if it was hard to focus in my mind and body, and if, you know, dyslexia had me feeling like out of order or having to return to things multiple times, you know, having a clean space and having things organized around you and having things in systems or routines became really helpful because it was already challenging enough what was going on in my brain that I didn't need to have additional external challenges, you know? And so where I could create flow and fluidity in my life, it allowed me to not have to take energy and time that was really being utilized to kind of manage my studying or, you know, any type of brain power that I had to output.
So you just said something so pivotal right there. And I want you to paint a picture for those that aren't even familiar with what dyslexia is. You said, what was going on in my brain?
Mm-hmm.
What was going on in your brain?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you were to even just open up a book and start reading, for me at times, kind of the letters and lines off the page would lift. Ooh. So a lot of patterns like you said, like this rug has a pattern all over it. It can elevate for me sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of a lift, and it's really easy for me to skip over lines. And then just the challenge of reading each individual word on top of that. And so, you know, if you compare it to athletics, you know, some people can run 50 yards, no problem. But for me, it'd be like running 50 yards with a weight vest on, ankle weights on, wrist weights on. There's all this kind of extra resistance due to how dyslexia impacts the mind and eye to page.
Reading was your main.
Oh, yeah. But it impacted everything. You know, I think anywhere where. Yeah, I think reading and grammar and writing was the biggest challenge. And then, you know, math, same thing. You start looking at a full page of numbers. I'm like, whoa. I look at spreadsheets. I'm like, this is a dyslexic person's nightmare. But OK, like take it one small bit at a time. And I think that's also another big thing that I applied to my life is just taking it one line, one word, you know, one sentence at a time. Yeah. And not to be overwhelmed by. Yeah.
Overwhelm is so real.
Oh, yes.
And what your brain was going through, I can only imagine. How was your self-talk? Mm. I mean, as a child, as a growing adult, like, why does it take me so long? You know, my 11-year-old, he's like, I hate reading. He'll tell me 1,001 times, I hate reading. I'm like, let's practice.
Yeah.
But you can say let's practice, but I mean, what was your love-hate relationship with that? Mm-hmm. And how do you combat the feelings of the perhaps shame or the inadequacy that's truly stemming from having to work harder with dyslexia?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think as a child, younger child, it was really kind of survival mode. It felt a little bit like a battlefield in the way that you didn't want to be called on in the classroom. Oof. You just wanted to kind of disappear. Yeah. Unlike you, I'm an extrovert. and so I went to a lot of I went to a lot of like humor in the classroom or, you know, connecting with people socially to kind of create allies or advocates, you know, someone that I could lean on or chuckle to in the moment of embarrassment. Or people asking me to, you know, what does that say? Or, you know, can you grab this book from the shelf, and not being able to orient it due to my lack of ability to read at that time. I had to leave for my resource class, which is where you would get extra help. It's resources, you get extra help, you have to leave. And it's always like a portable classroom in the back of the school. Yeah, it's like never anything like awesome. You're like, dang it, I have to go to resource, you know. But I had to leave at a certain time, so I'd have to get up in front of my class and leave, and that was so embarrassing.
Yeah.
And even when I was much younger, I couldn't read a hand clock, so I was sitting there kind of sweating, wondering like, oh, is it 12:45 now? Is it 12:45 now? And I'd get really creative in how I was going to ask different people. And ask it in a way to where they weren't recognizing that I was struggling to actually read that clock.
So you spent a lot of time wasting your energy and also just like your self-confidence, right?
Yeah, a lot of time wasting energy figuring out how to avoid being put in certain situations, and then having a plan for when you are in the situation. How are you going to get out of it? How are you going to move through it? And or just having to sit kind of in the embarrassment of, oh man, I've just been exposed.
Did you ever get teased or bullied?
Sure. But I became really like the class clown about it. So I was going to make fun of myself before I really let anyone else hurt me. And that became a part of like the survival mechanism.
So what did they say to you? I'm curious. What did they say to you?
You know, I think here's an example or a story of a time where I kind of beat everyone to the punch is that I was called on for popcorn reading. Oh, by the way,
popcorn reading.
You guys.
Oh, I remember popcorn that. Reading. Popcorn, I'm done.
Yeah, exactly. Where popcorn reading is, for those who don't know, you're in the classroom and one person starts reading and then I would go, popcorn, Kate. So then you would pick up on the next. Yeah.
Where are we in the paragraph?
Totally. On the next line. So then I would just start like making stuff up and all the kids would start to giggle because it wasn't what was in the page. And, you know, or I'd go up to be called to like go up onto the board and do, you know,
a math equation,
have to answer it. And I would just like start drawing weird pictures, you know, anything to distract from the fact that I didn't know. Right. So that is, and the kids just thought it was hilarious. You know, I was like the troublemaker, and who wants to be focused doing work anyways? Maybe a small few, but if I was going to bring this kind of fun and humor, you know, no one was saying anything, or they would just, you know, they would identify it and point it out. And that enough was, you know, felt embarrassing. Yeah.
That's such a beautiful word.
Yeah.
But what did you truly feel inside?
Yeah.
At that moment.
Yeah. It's total survival mode. You know, I think it's panic. It's fight or flight. It's freezing in the moment. Usually it was fight or flight. It was like, I got to figure a way out of this as quickly as possible. But it's humiliating, you know? And in an odd way, as I sit here and think about it, it like did not motivate me to be like, oh, I want to go home and become the best reader in the class. Because I think what people don't realize is that it's like, there's truly a block there. No matter how hard I study, no matter how much I practice, there are truly things that are in place that are the disconnects. And you just start to kind of find your little tools and find your little ways. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, I didn't have dyslexia. I have dyslexia, and I have found all these kind of small ways to allow it to work for me. And I became a wild advocate for myself. And that came more in like middle school, high school, and college. But when I was like, you know, in the younger years of second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, oof, that was really hard to navigate and hard to experience. And then, you know, I came to a place where I learned, you know, what is it to advocate for yourself? What are your rights? You know, you have an IEP in school, you get certain rights for your, that match up to the disability that you have through the testing that you do, but also testing.
Yeah. Holy fuck.
Yes. And I'm not even talking about the testing that's done in the classroom, like having a test. I'm talking about you have to get tested every 2 years for your learning disability and to get your rights.
Right. Get your freaking rights when things are not even, you know, they're not hard enough already.
Yeah. So what testing is like, if you don't mind me sharing, because this is also was excruciating as a child, but you know, you go and you spend anywhere from like 3 to 5 days, and they're testing your range and your ability. And to do that, to find your limit, to find your range and your ability, what do you have to do in testing? You have to go to the point of failure, right? So you're
already feeling like a failure
every day in the classroom. So you get pulled back into another portable classroom in the back of this campus, and you're in there with, you know, one other adult, and you're going through all of these different kind of exercises. And you're just being tested to failure, tested to failure, tested to failure, tested to failure. And it's really, it feels like you're in a boxing match of your capabilities and abilities, right? It's like one of the most deflating experiences ever. And it's exhausting mentally.
Yeah.
Absolutely exhausting. And I've worked with a lot of kids and mentored a lot of kids who have had to go through this process. And for me, it's about how do we build them up and set expectations so they're going into this with the right kind of mindset and perspective, knowing that you are being tested to failure. It's not a pass fail. It's a fail, because they're trying to find those boundaries and where you can absolutely max yourself out to. But that was just always brutal and something I never, ever looked forward to. And now for like sports, we'll do a concussion test. And they're like, say the, you know, the months of the years backwards. And I'm like, PTSD from like, you know, my dyslexia testing, yeah. Like, you know, every 2 year testing. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay, here we go. Oh so. God.
Well, okay. It's not, what did you say? It's not pass or fail. It's failure.
Yeah.
It's let's take you to failure. And something that I just kind of want to like bless your heart with is my little 11-year-old Nolan. He was told me he's my little philosopher, mm-hmm. right? Brilliant minds, right? And he said, he told me one day, he goes, it's not failure. You don't fail. It's success because you have to fail in order to be successful. Mm. And I think
that's wonderful wisdom for him at that age.
He is so wise. But I wanted to like go back on the perspective mm-hmm. aspect when we pass, fail, perspective, thinking about all these things, thinking about your place in the classroom, growing up, talking to yourself at the same time, trying to be funny, all these different mm-hmm. hats that you're wearing. You know, you seem like such a positive person, but then I want to take it back to, I have to touch on this subject of, you know, the perspective of I'm toxic. I have a toxic brain. I have a sick brain. Mm. You know, you came from such a beautiful household, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how did you overcome that perspective at the time where you were sweating and you were like, I'm in survival mode?
Yeah.
How did you overcome those moments?
You know, what's really interesting, I love this question because it allows me to reflect on perhaps what my perspective was at that time. And I never thought, like, I knew I had dyslexia, but I never thought something was wrong or broken or toxic with me. Mm-hmm. Like, it was almost like they were meeting outside of myself. It's like it was the school against what my capabilities were. I never felt broken or disabled, you know, it's a learning disability at the time is right. What we called it. And we have shifted to differences at this point. But I never felt like, gosh, my brain can't, like, I never talked bad about what my brain could or could not do. It was kind of like I was always thinking about what was the next step and how I could be prepared for that. And a lot of it was kind of the focus for me was on the outside and what was coming my way rather than being internal and blaming and shaming myself. It was kind of like, oh, this person is about to ask me what my address is and I'm in fourth grade and I don't know how to spell, you know, the road that I live on. Mm. And so at that point, I don't come in to myself and say, you're so dumb. You can't do it. Why can't you figure it out? Why can't you remember? I'm like, okay, I wrote it down on a piece of paper. It's in my backpack right now. And I can pull that out, take a look at it, and then I can write it on, you know, that kind of stuff.
Here's my cheat sheet.
Or like you, like as a child and someone was going to ask me to say something or spell something, I would start scanning the room. What has it written down somewhere? Where can I pull this word from? Where can I borrow, you know, the spelling of it from? And I would borrow from like things written around me. And so, you know, there's, again, that's another survival tactic.
But now, do you think that comes from the child's imaginary kind of abilities? Like, I assume, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but were you very imaginative as a child?
I became like street smart, if that makes any kind of sense. But
back to the survival.
Yeah. And I think I was creative in really very realistic ways. I wasn't creative in, you know, like, I don't know, perhaps I was, you know, I spent a lot of time outside and building and playing right. and dreaming and, you know, all of those things. Of course you have to be a vivid dreamer to be able to stand on top of a podium, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, we're going to get to that. Don't worry.
Yeah. And I had a lot of joy in sports. And so, but yeah, I think I became really street smart and I had a way of reading people as well, mm-hmm. That I noticed that I still do today, is I can sense who is willing to help. Like I'm really an elite person to call in. I can call in help really well. Like I knew what person in the classroom was going to let me review their notes or borrow their notes and which would be like, nope, I don't share my notes. Like I didn't even have to ask to get there. I was just very, very aware of who was going to be like, okay, I mean, change this, this. And I'm like, okay, you know, and who was going to help kind of push me along. Because I could run for so long, then I'd hit a bump and then I would need someone to kind of push me over the bump to keep things moving. And it wasn't realistic to have a teacher stop by 15 times within, you know, one assignment. And so I became really elite at like reading people, understanding who could provide help, who was willing to provide help, how to call in help. I became like a very elite advocate of sharing what are the things that I need to succeed? What are things that are going to disrupt my success? And to say, you know, my rights are my rights. Even as a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old going up to an adult that didn't care if I had an IEP, you know, in high school, mm-hmm. I'd have teachers say, you know, I had extra time on test and I got to take it in a different room to not have distractions. That was a part of my rights. Mm-hmm. I had a teacher every time I asked him to go take my test down to the resource room so that I could just go straight there and start the test. Nope. You have to come in the classroom. You'll have to get it from me at the desk. And then you'll have to walk out in front of all of your peers and leave. And all of them will ask, where are you going? Why does she get to leave? And so every time you got to explain, hi, I have dyslexia. I have rights because of my learning differences. I'm going to go take my tests in a different room where I have extra time and my own space. At a certain point, I eventually did say this in front of my whole classroom. And because the teacher just kept challenging me on it.
Bullying you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's really interesting because dyslexia is not a disability or difference that you can see on the outside.
Exactly.
It's a total internal battle and war. And here I was, the top athlete at school. I had a great group of friends. I could communicate. I could make people laugh. I could, you know, do these types of things. But the playing field was not level for me in the classroom. And so I utilized those rights and I got a lot of pushback from teachers. I mean, peers are one thing. The teachers were a nightmare as well.
I'm going to pause you right there. The dyslexia was one thing, but the internal battle, the war that was going on within you, that just kind of whatever fire that spurred up within you, right? And you were talking about the learning disability versus the word disability versus external versus internal, right? You know, you see someone obviously with a cane and a limp and you're like, oh, they're disabled.
Yeah.
You know, they get the handicap parking tag, right? But let's just take this to other instances out there, other people that are listening, watching, that are thinking, yeah, I have something too, right?
Mm-hmm.
My personal experience is that I have autoimmune. I have Raynaud's. On the outside, I'm like,
yep.
Life is great. Today woke up with a smile. But then you really don't know that some days I have extreme flare-ups. I feel like an 80-year-old woman. Mm-hmm. My mind takes me down a spiral. My hands turn purple. They turn red. They swell up, right? I can't take off my dog's collar. I can't hold my dog's leash. You know, whatever it may be, the things spiral. You can't see these things from the outside. Just like dyslexia. So if you're talking to someone about, you know, the word disability or just in general, when we're talking about the relationship to the self, how do you give yourself back that power in moments of pure defeat?
Yeah. I think for me, having an IEP and being coached by my parents and kind of my case manager at the school that kind of helped and worked as my advocate as well, was really important. And not to bend on that, not to be bullied, not even to be bullied by authority, which had the upper hand and power. You know, and I think, and sticking to the plan, you know, I had a plan that worked, and it was that I had to go down to this, you know, resource room where it was a quiet room. And
well, yes, but I mean, even past school years, right?
Yeah.
Just in general, how do you, anything that might seem defeating to you?
Yeah.
It, say you're speaking on behalf of everyone else, mindset, relationship to the self. How do you bring yourself back together? How do you set that restart button?
I think at the end of the day, where we can get tripped up and we get in our own way, and I can feel like, oh, maybe I'm not good enough for this, or maybe, you know, what have you. I come back to, I'm pretty proud of the person I am and who I look at in the mirror. And if I can just come back to being just me, like no one else, don't try to be the professor from Harvard that is speaking on the TED Talk. Like, that's not me. Don't try to be that person. Don't try to be, you know, the head coach when you are the captain of the water polo team. Come back to you. Anytime I tried to be anything else but myself, when I abandoned myself, I always lost. If I could come home to me, I will always win, because there's, I know this place so well. I know what my earned experience is. I know what my truths are. I know who I am.
What's your truth?
What's my truth?
What's your truth?
I mean, it's everything that I've earned in this lifetime. You know, my truth is I know how to do hard things. My truth is I know how to ask for the things that I need. My truth is if you're not in alignment in morals and values and not a person of integrity, I probably don't want to be too close to you. because I know my morals. I know my values. I know I'm a woman of integrity. And so if I can come back to that place that I know that landscape well and not try to be outside of that, I'm going to be okay. And more times than not, I'm going to be able to deliver something that's authentic and truthful and grounded.
Grounded.
Yeah.
You said it so right. Going back to your truth, becoming grounded, getting back into that aura essence space that is, this is me.
Yeah.
This is me. And you created that. You were put into water polo.
Mm-hmm.
What age were you put into water polo?
My mom took me to the pool to start swimming when I was 3 years old. And like, that's where I got all of the energy out. And I was then later introduced to water polo at 12 years old. So I had swam forever. That has always been the free therapy. It's been my, it was basically my prescription, right? That's was the replacement, was the Adderall or the Ritalin, and in place it was the swimming. So swimming's always been a safe place for me. You know, I've competed at a high level for many years. And I have teammates that are like, I can't believe you still go to the pool every day, Cammie. You're nuts. I hate swimming. And I'm like, honestly, I love myself better when I've hit the pool and I have swam.
Well, I mean, totally can directly relate to that.
Yes.
People are like, you're crazy. You wake up at this time, you jump in the cold water. Your hair's a mess. I mean, my hairstylist told me yesterday my hair was green.
Yes.
I was like, what? Absolutely not. What are you talking about? But it goes back to the mental health aspect. Mental health aspect of, you know, the parasympathetic nervous system, calming everything down. There's something so motherly about the relationship with ourselves and water and how it holds you and takes you back to that kind of womb essence. But the mental health aspect of being in the water, I think you can relate that you go underwater, can't hear a thing.
Yep.
Everything washes away. It's like being on drugs, but I don't do drugs, promise, you know, but, you know, everything becomes calm, crystal clear. Yeah. Your brain starts to do something miraculous where you can just be like, all right, not like everything's not floating around in there. Everything's The lines are clearer. I can think of my lists. I can get better ideas. I don't know what that is, but it's magic.
Well, that's who we need to invite on next year's podcast, is the person who understands the relationship between water and mental health and the human mind. But yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, there's no better place to collect yourself in the midst of a major game and a major tournament with the stands filled with fans screaming than just taking a second or two underwater.
Yes.
And then coming back up and resetting. Yep.
Yep.
Yes.
God, so amazing. So you built that, what did you say, the girl squad, that when you started to kind of feel that camaraderie, like everyone was on your team, right? No one was out there against you. You know, there was no authority that didn't, well, we'll get into coaches, but believe in you. No one was trying to call you out. But everyone's like, we're working together. Yeah. What did that camaraderie do for you and you do for your brain's chemistry of the sense of belonging and feeling like an equal?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, as I've said over and over, but athletics has been such a safe place for me. When I think about, you know, my relationship with my teammates and my relationship with the sport, there was no difference than how I advocated for myself in the classroom. I advocated for myself within the team setting as well. And so my coaches knew what I needed to be successful. I need whiteboards. I need a beat to kind of be able to visually see things before we go back out. I need you to break down different drills and things like that. And so then I can go and make it happen. My teammates were also aware of where my challenges lied. I knew all the plays. I studied all the plays. I, you know, studied with certain teammates. Yet I always picked one person, because I told you I'm really good at like calling in help. I always picked one person on our team that was just excellent. That was their strength, was knowing the plays under pressure. And I would say, okay, like, I know the play, but if we get into this moment and the coach calls out this play on the lineup, I'm going to look at you and I just want you to remind me either, yes, you're in the right spot or you need to go here. And it was like just this kind of handshake contract that I had with a teammate during each season on whatever team. Mm-hmm. And it gave me that extra confidence that I knew that my strengths could have somebody else's back. Mm-hmm. And somebody else's strengths could have my back where my weaknesses lied. And if I sat there and masked them, if I never communicated them, you know, the team could be halfway down the pool in the middle of a play. And I'm sitting here still freaking out about where I'm supposed to be rather than just doing it and keeping it moving. And so I think one of the worst things we can do to ourselves is to hold those things so tight and so close to us. I, by no ways am I burdening anyone by letting them know, hey, there's some adjustments that I need, or just be mindful, you know, that I'm moving a little bit slower or I'm thinking a little bit different, you know? And if you want to hop in, like, I'm happy to learn or get your feedback.
Well, it goes back to that control thing, right? Like 100%, you know, like when, you know, you can't control one situation and they're trying to control another situation, the communication isn't, you know, up to speed, right? It goes back to like, sometimes you just have to let it go, like let it go off into its own land, recollect yourselves at a later point.
Yeah.
But I think it's really beautiful that, you know, you did build, I'm going back to building that squad.
Yeah.
Friendship, that little like, pod of trust. I think that's a beautiful outcome from what you did come from.
Yeah.
And how it created more structure in your life.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say in the very beginning about the plan? I had a plan.
Mm-hmm. In regards to just ensuring that
I had to stick to my plan of life. I had my goals. I had my dreams.
Mm-hmm.
No one told you you can't get there, right?
Definitely there were coaches and teachers that said it, but
parent wise,
no, I had totally incredibly supportive parents that always championed the dream.
Let's go. Let's, okay, so yeah. Championing the dream from the parents. Awesome.
Yes.
Super rare. But then also, I want to go back to the negativity. Let's go back to those demons. Let's go back to those haters out there, those coaches, those teachers.
Mm-hmm.
What did they say to you? How did they try to bring you down?
Yeah, some of it was placement. They wanted to put me in classes that were not college prep, so I couldn't go on to go to college. And so, you know, my mom was like, no, she's going to be in all college prep classes so that she can continue to move on to college if she earns that ability to do so. We're not going to put her in lower level classes, assuming that's all she can do. We're going to put her in higher level classes. And if she can't manage that, then she can be put back. You know, I think there was constant battles and war over my rights. Using a calculator, getting extra time, going to a different classroom to take a test. Constant battles by grown adults who are supposed to be here championing students and leveling the playing field, but they could not see it as a level. Rather, they perhaps saw it as an advantage. You know, I had a coach say, like, I was being recruited by Stanford. Cammie could never go to Stanford.
To your face?
Yeah.
And what did you say back?
My mom was in the classroom at the time this coach said this, and my mom said, don't ever tell my child that, and this meeting's over, and we walked out.
Oh, I know. I want to meet you, mom.
I know. She's my mom is a fierce advocate as well, and a teacher. So I think, there's definitely have been people who didn't believe in me.
But what did the seed within you that's growing, that's evolving, that's shaping something brighter, bigger, more competitive. Were you like, I don't know this coach's name.
Yeah.
So-and-so. Were you like, fuck you, like in your head, like I can do whatever the fuck I want.
Yeah.
You watch me. Did you, at that point, did this give you the drive to like excel? Were you like fire in the belly? Let's go. Game on.
Yeah.
I'm going to.
No, I think
spoiler, I'm going to go to the Olympics.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I had a true, true love for the game of water polo. I had a true love for athletics in general, but I had a true love for the game of water polo. And it wasn't about all of the noise. Like, I got to go to the pool. My girlfriends were there. I got to get a little bit better each day at something. I got a ton of atta girls while I was there, a lot of positive feedback from coaches and teammates. And I was watching and feeling myself get better and better every time. Mm-hmm. And so of course I remember that comment. I still remember it. And, you know, when I graduated from USC with a degree and went on to 3 Olympic Games, like, I remember that comment, you know? Yeah. And so for me, I'm really proud of what I did despite people who were in, again, positions of authority that didn't believe in me. But he wasn't my motivation. He wasn't.
I love that you say that. I do love that you say that, but I do also loved the other aspect that it did fuel you in a way.
Yeah.
My husband is dyslexic as well. And he, at a very young age, I will never forget the story. At a very young age, he had a teacher tell him, you know, you're nobody, you're not going to be able to get anywhere, you're dumb, or whatever words that he specifically used. And this teacher specifically did triathlons on the weekend or something. And my husband, from a very young age, took on the sport of triathlons. And I just remember just saying I would fight and, you know, I just wanted to win so bad. I would train so hard. I would do whatever I could. I would wake up in the middle of the night and go for miles and miles of running. And he saw that teacher at like a neighborhood race or whatever. Yeah. And he literally like zoomed past him and he was like, see you later. And he beat him. And he's just like, that was his thing. And later on, you know, it excelled him into being a professional athlete in the craziest, you know, races you could ever do. And I think that just pushed him even further to becoming you know, in charge of his own business, you know, not having gone to college, like all of those things built up to where you get to, right? Yes. It fuels you. You have your own business now. But I kind of, So anyways, I'm going to jump back to another topic too, but let you reflect on that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I also think there's probably a part of us that feels like we have to prove ourselves. You know, there might be a bit of that in the high performance side of us and that drive within us, you know, and I say us, I'm including your husband in that story you just shared.
I'll include myself in
this. Right. It's just that desire to be like, yeah, I'm going to continue to show up and show that I can and I will. You know, again, I don't think back at that teacher or teachers or coaches that kind of poo-pooed on me. And I don't think like, I don't go to bed thinking about their faces being like, I'm going to prove to you, you know, like I actually, there's a lot more energizing things and a lot more joy. Like joy is what motivates me, not anger. And I have teammates that love to get, you know, headphones on and get angry and they're like firing up to like go do their thing. But like, I'm not driven by anger. That's like the quickest way to just flatten me and distract me and take me out of my body. Like I am driven by joy, excitement, intensity, peak experiences. Like that fires me up. And so, you know, again, there was like a back kind of filing cabinet those went to. And when I eventually arrived to some successes, it felt like, dude, are you serious? You doubted it? Like, come on. And perhaps, you know, those deep, dark filing cabinets still continue to drive me to hit certain levels. But also there's an excitement within myself to see what I can do. It's not even about them, but I think there's some residuals consciously or subconsciously that perhaps continues to drive me to want to prove my ability when I was so doubted at a young age and told I was not capable.
Your abilities, your rights.
Yeah.
Goes back. It all stems from that little child, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's go on to the Atta girls, right? Let's go on to the relationship with the Atta girls. I call them the Atta girls, even though I know you're saying like you got a lot of Atta girls. Yeah. I just like named the girl squad, right? Okay. They're called the Atta girls.
Okay.
So let's talk about your teammates. Let's talk about being in the locker room. Let's talk about being in front of so many people in something that I think, I know obviously I can relate with, a lot of other females can relate with, being in your swimsuit.
Yeah.
Right? Let's talk about body image.
Okay.
I really want to jump into this. Wearing a swimsuit on national television, I know that you probably weren't, or you could have been, were you so on social media at that time where people, like you saw what people would say or call things out? Or how did the body image aspect come across with all the females in there?
Yeah. You know, I am grateful to talk about this subject and I'm grateful for my experience around body image and my awareness of my body at a young age. I grew up in a family where I have a dad who's 6'2", a brother who's 6'4", another brother who's 6'1", and I myself am 5'11". My mom is 5'4". She wears size 7 in women's, which I wore in second grade. My body looks nothing like my mom. I look exactly like my dad, and my brothers have similar builds. For whatever reason, like my family got it right in the love and the support in the body department because my brothers never made fun of me. They never shamed me. I would borrow their clothes all the time and their shoes all the time. They didn't care. My mom constantly was on repeat with big is beautiful. You know, obviously I would come in and I'd be like, my legs are huge, mom. Like, when am I going to get knees? And my mom's like, those are your knees. Those are your legs. You know, like big is beautiful. Those legs are going to take you somewhere. Like why she felt compelled to tell me that is beyond me because there's no athletes in my family either. I am the only and first athlete to come out of my immediate family. My mom doesn't even know how to swim.
Am I getting emotional?
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry. No, that's okay. And so they just constantly allowed, you know, us to just exist in our bodies. And I did so much playing outside, and, you know, we'd have a pond on our property when it rained, and I'd be out in a bathing suit. We'd be like 4, 5, 6 years old out in a bathing suit, like paddling a surfboard around, like putting mud on our, you know, like we were like such those rogue, like wild country kids.
Right.
But I was constantly in a bathing suit. My brother would always laugh and say, he'd bring over friends. I'd be like, oh, that's my little sister. She's in a bathing suit. It's like, just kind of how it is. I have always found an immense amount of comfort in a bathing suit. From the time I got my first bathing suit till today, I probably could have done this interview in a bathing suit and would have been comfortable. I probably would have wanted my angles to be right, but I would have been comfortable.
Well, okay. You're just bringing back childhood memories, which yes. I love this.
Yes.
I love going back to our inner child. You're saying like, when will my knees form?
Yeah.
I remember. Like,
these are my knees.
These are my knees.
I love them.
Kneecaps. At least you have kneecaps.
I don't.
You're alive. Yeah. But I remember as a child, so my two older sisters, I grew up with all females. Mm-hmm. My two older sisters were 40-hour a week competitive gymnasts.
Wow.
Literally did not form breasts until they probably quit the sport, graduated high school.
Yep.
You know, they were, had 24 packs on their stomach.
Yep.
I don't even know where those muscles came from. And they're like I have got to show you pictures.
Yes.
And then here's me, you know, soccer player, tennis, swimmer, just like little cute pudgy Katie. Mm. And I just remember I had those thoughts as a young child being like, why don't I look like them?
Mm.
I hate my inner thighs so much as a child, like as a young yes. child being like, why do my thighs rub together? And that brings almost tears into my eyes because mm-hmm. like, Cammie, would you, if you saw yourself as a young child right there, would you say, Cammie, when are your knees going to form? You know,
no, I'd be
when
like, you're a badass.
Yeah. When I look at myself and be like, why are your thighs rubbing together? Yeah. But it goes back to, I think, males, females, whomever you label yourself as, going back to that perfect body,
mm-hmm.
perfect body. I know everyone deals with body image issues every single day, right? One day someone could be up, one day someone could be down, but that definition of the perfect body and going back to the relationship to the self,
mm-hmm.
right? You had a great advocate for you, but at the end of the day, as a female speaking, what did you tell yourself to kind of bring you back in and mm-hmm. saying the line that you said so beautifully, this is me.
Yeah. And I had such purpose for my body. You know, I think athletics really was a blessing. You know, I think that can go in other ways for other athletes. But I always loved that I was big and strong and powerful. Like it was such a gift to every team I got to be on. And it was such a gift to the opportunities that kept arising for me. But yeah, this total, like kind of this ability to be comfortable in your body and existing with like giant brothers and giant, you know what I mean? Like we're just big people. We took up space, but, yeah, I think coming back to just this is it, and it's a part of my personality. It's like my whole body is such a blessing. It's such a gift.
Such a beautiful tool to yes. like where you've grown into.
Yes. Yeah. But no, I think it always had great purpose. You know, I think it was interesting in retirement, feeling like I was fully responsible for my body at that point. That was an interesting shift for me because I'd always had strength and conditioning trainers and coaches that were, you know, planning the workouts and you know, telling me what to do with my body. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, nobody's telling me what to do with my body anymore. Oh. Like now it's my responsibility.
So you had to create your recovery, your self-care.
Mm-hmm. I had to figure out what was movement for me after training 6.5 hours a day, 6 days a week.
movement, nourishment, self-care. I want to go into the self-care. You were told so long, Tammy, perform.
Yeah.
Excel. Do better.
Mm-hmm.
Be better. This is your routine.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, recover, Cammy, recover, recover. But now you're at the point where you're like, I was always told to perform. I was always told to excel. How do I take time for myself? Yeah. What do you do for self-care? What does self-care look like for you anyways?
Right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just in general. At the moments when you're so much of a performer.
I think while I was training and in the midst of my national team career, self-care was really preparation. So again, making sure that you are running a home and an environment that is in order so that there's always good food in the fridge. There's always clean towels and clean sheets so that you can feel comfortable and, settled. You know, for me, a clean space is a settled space, a place where I can truly relax. So preparation, running a home that's in order so that it's not taking energy from you, but it's rather energizing you and can put you at peace.
Oh,
yes. Food's never been like, I know how to eat well. I've never counted calories. I've never, I've been aware of like, what is a range of protein I need? What is a range of, vegetables, fruits, grains, carbs, all that stuff, but never have gotten down to nitty gritty detail. I feel very intuitive with, wow, I felt really crappy after eating that sandwich and trying to swim for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. Like next time I'm not going to eat a sandwich with pesto before practice, like what is too heavy? What is too light? Where do you feel depleted? What do you need more of? What do you need less of? I have always been intuitive in that way. And even outside of my intense training, still feel that way with eating. Like, oh man, I feel like I need protein. I feel like I need a lot of protein right now, or I just need a lot of leafy greens. Like I can feel like intuitively what my body is asking for.
Well, I think that's very smart for a lot of people to hear intuitively, listening to yourself. We live in such a world where I do this all the time. People are like, oh my God, so-and-so's doing that or doing that.
Right.
Maybe I should try that. It comes with, the whole topic of what's trendy, what's working for them. Mm-hmm. But then it's like, whoa, step back. And do you even know your body at the end of the day? Yeah. Are you listening to your body? What do you need at what time of the day or what time of the month for a female?
That's totally true. Yes. So home, eating, and then recovery. So, acupuncture, massage, chiropractor, ice baths, heat before, all of those things that really to me was part of self-care, but fell under the title of being an athlete. That's a part of preparing yourself as an athlete. Now it feels like self-care because it's not like readily available. Yeah. Required or readily available. And then who are you spending your time with? What are the thoughts you're allowing yourself to think? What are the, shows that you're watching, Yeah. So something's coming up for you here.
We have to pause and then I'm going to let you continue, but who are you spending your time with?
Yeah.
Toxic relationships. Are they serving me or are they hindering you? What did you find about that little topic right there?
Yeah. I think, again, when I'm looking at this in the most intense time of my training, in the midst of my career with the national team, circle was small. And, a lot of times that process weeded people out automatically because you're not available. So people either are willing to cheer for you on the sideline and be patient till you have a life again, or they're not. A lot of it, I spent a lot of time with family and teammates, and your teammates really become your family in a lot of different ways. But, and the teammates that are in line with you, you're not going to be in alignment with every teammate. You're not going to love every teammate. You're not going to get along with every teammate, but as long as you can cultivate trust and enough respect, you can go kick butt. Like maybe I won't ever hang out with you ever outside of practice, but if we can cultivate enough trust and respect, then we can move mountains together. And there's a joy in that.
How did you take that? I mean, you're talking on a teammate level. But how did you take that, you know, the topic of toxic relationships into the life that you're living right now? You know, you're 36 years old. How do you view other people or people that come into your life and strategically spend your time wisely with those people?
I have become very protective over my time and very thoughtful about how I want to utilize and use my time. I want to feel good within myself always. And we're human. And there's people that can disrupt that. And there's people who, you know, like to get in there and shake things around, you know, based off of what triggers us or what can, you know, elevate our emotions. And so I'm really thoughtful, yes, about the company I keep. And, you know, for me, it's important not to be around all like-minded people. I love hearing different perspectives. I love to hear how people are thinking and doing and being. I've got a lot of space to hear it. It doesn't mean I have to apply it to my own life. But I think the biggest thing, especially as a kind of go-getter and this desire to constantly be the best that I can be. Like, what a waste if you're not operating like in your full capacity, you know? Right. Like, I would feel like, man, we're given all these gifts and all of these abilities to do things. Why would I sleep on that? Like, to me, that would just bum me out to be living at 20% or 30%. Why not live at 100%? And so I want people around me who want to see me at 100%. I want people around me who can celebrate successes or champion successes. And if you can't champion it, celebrate. If you can't celebrate it, champion it. And if you can't do either, then you don't want to see me reaching a higher level. Something's coming up for you. And if I have you around, I'll never reach a higher level because you don't want me there. You're not putting that energy around me, you know? And that is the same energy 100% that I try to return to everyone that I'm around. I'm like, you got greatness. You got gifts. Are you tackling it? How do you want to get after it? How can I love you? How can I support you? I believe in you, even on your hardest day. Like, dang, we're just getting better today, you know?
Well, the energy that you can cultivate from another person is so vital.
Yes.
Right? Someone can bring you up. Someone can bring you down. You know immediately, I want none of that, right? That's about you back into, you know, being that athlete, right? Like, are you my teammate or are you not? Are you trying to support me? Are we teaming up here? You know, we live in that world now where people are, I said it on another show, like, you know, someone maybe in your same field is doing something great and getting all the sponsors or this and that. We just had that great conversation. And you're like, well, how did you do that? And there's genuine curiosity. And they're probably thinking, no, why do I want them to excel beyond me or to get to this level? But in all reality, hello, there's space for all of us in this world. And we should be helping one another.
Yes.
So the relationships are totally key.
Yes.
Totally key in life.
And you're speaking a little bit about generosity of spirit. Like, why, if I went somewhere a little bit further or a place where no one has gone before, why wouldn't I want to toss it back and bring up the next wave of people? Why would I not want people to have easier access to the things that I really had to hard kind of navigate and go through? Why wouldn't I want to make it easier on the next generation? Why wouldn't I want someone to push me and be better than me? Why wouldn't I want to share the gifts that I received? Like, to me, generosity of spirit is also another big thing that, like, we don't have to hold things too tightly. And if someone else is on popping off right now, great, pop off, like, go get it, you know? And then return to yourself. I'm not trying to be, you know, that person I'm idolizing. I'm trying to find it in the way that I know is true to myself, right? And there's certain things that certain ingredients that, you know, create that, but there's also come back to you.
Your home.
Come
home.
Back to you. Yeah.
The vessel exactly. of you, right? You were talking about being in charge of yourself, your body, your decisions, right? After transitioning out of athletics, or being a hardcore professional, going to the Olympics, yes. having someone tell you exactly what to do. Transitioning out of sports can be daunting.
Yes, very much.
Right? So how did you overcome that fear-based mindset
yeah.
associated with that change?
Yeah. Transitioning off the national team was really challenging for me. Mm-hmm. I was with the team for 13 years. I knew that I wanted to retire. I retired with a great relationship with water polo. I had a ton of respect and love for my coach. I had a ton of respect and love for the athletes that I had gone through multiple quads with. It's really a dream way to retire. And I got to finish on the top. We won a gold at my last Olympic Games. And after that, I had retired. So that is best case scenario. That's not every athlete's experience. And I still had a hard time. I say all of that just because I still had a hard time. Yeah. With that being like the whole world's eyes on you and you're like building up to this like peak point, which is the Olympic Games. And then you come back and it's just like, hello, is anybody here? You know, it's like, it just becomes, it's just you in your living space. And you're like, I guess we're back to just regular old life and there's no next practice to go to. So it became really actually quite overwhelming to me. I had a lot of free time that I didn't know what to do with. I had to figure out, you know, what does employment look like? You know, and that was just like, how am I going to make money was the first kind of place to start. And, you know, I had some things that were in place. They didn't turn out to be exactly what I thought they were. And so I pivoted. And what you do, which I didn't realize was normal because I had been doing the same thing for 29 years. And I'm like, I committed to this. Now I've got to stick with it forever. You know, like I was such an all-in mindset, especially as an athlete. Right. So I think, you know, it was overwhelming on many levels. I ended up ending a relationship after 10 years. So my dog and my boyfriend moved out. I had to figure out what my work was going to be. You know, I didn't want to not be busy. So I was just booking my social calendar to the max because I didn't want downtime.
You didn't want to hear the silence.
Totally.
So you were you reinventing yourself at that time or were you running away from reinvention?
No. Like just not even, I was just burning the candle on all ends. And if there wasn't an end, I was burning it straight on the body of the candle. I was like, let's just do as much as we can and stay in this intensity. And eventually it came to a breaking point where, you know, I was really thrashing and those closest to me, I was kind of throwing it on them to help me get out of that feeling. And I recognized like, no matter how much I thrash, like my family can't get me out of this or get me through it. My boyfriend can't get me out of this or get me through it. Like I actually have to do it myself and I need professional help to do it. So I had called, a therapist was recommended to me, called her up and was like, hi, I'm a mess. I can't even tell you who I am, where I am. And I'm completely overwhelmed. And she goes, great. Why don't you come in and see me this week? So I started that path and really started to kind of get more grounded and more organized in what my path and plan was moving forward. And then one of the men's water polo players lived in the community. And I called him and I said, hey, do you ever go swimming? And he was like, no. Do you want a coaching job? I was like, no, I don't need a coaching job. I just need to figure out like who I am, you know? And I was like, I just need someone to swim with. And he was like, okay, meet me at the pool at 7 a.m. tomorrow. And we swam every single day during this kind of intense transition period of about a year and a half to 2 years. Mm-hmm. And no matter what was on my calendar, what was happening in my life, I started my day every morning at 6 a.m. down at that pool, jumping in the pool, whether I swam a lap or I swam a whole set. And I had teammates, you know, newfound teammates that were there. So between therapy, that swimming, and then eventually cultivating a series of mentors to kind of help me figure out what life looks like after athletics and what life looks like in the working world. Mm-hmm. That's when I started to find a flow out of it.
Well, what you needed back from what I've seen, from what you've mentioned with your childhood, is that routine structure creates that discipline that helps you thrive.
Yep.
And that's what you had kind of lost.
Yes.
So that's part of your ability to be like, all right, I'm coming back to me.
Yep. That's absolutely right. And that's something that, you know, I live by now, and I can feel when I'm out of structure and when I'm out of routine, and I always feel a little like, ooh, you know, like I feel like a bag floating in the air a little bit. And so, you know, what is it do I need to revisit? You know, is it going back to the calendar? Is it going back to my space? Is it going back to just setting myself up for success? And it's helpful, but also creating space for spontaneity and creating space for just plopping and resting and having no plans. That's very much a part of the routine as well, is having those pockets to have nothing on the calendar and no plan.
And not feeling pressured.
Yeah.
Or let's go into the topic of external validation. Mm-hmm. You know, when you transitioned out and you felt, I have to do this, I have to go to this route or that route, or perhaps this job, I have to do a corporate desk job maybe now. Maybe I should try something else, because I will be validated in this hardcore profession. And going back to, wait a second, what am I truly worthy of, right? How did you kind of regain that self-worth?
Yeah. You hit it right on the head of just coming back to yourself. So I went out and I embarked on being someone who I wasn't, you know. I went into outside sales and everyone's like, you're going to love it. You're an athlete. You're competitive. Guess what? I'm not motivated by money. It's no surprise. We were paid nothing as Olympic athletes, but I wasn't motivated by money or watching, you know, getting the sale. And I didn't fully perhaps believe completely, like, what we were selling was great, but it wasn't like my passion or my full belief was behind the product I was selling. And during the time that I was working in outside sales, I was also starting mentorship with youth athletes. And so I had maybe three kids that I would do my 9 to 5. I'd come home and then I'd do, you know, video mentor sessions with kiddos. And it was so positive for me because I was still feeling like a little bit of finding myself in this next chapter of my life. But it was so grounding to work with these athletes because it was something I knew so well. And it was something that allowed me to really utilize the experience that I had gained from the field I just came from, which was elite athletics. And at one point I realized, oh, if I built a roster of 15 athletes or more, and then I did speaking engagements or camps or clinics, then it would equal what I'm making in this outside sales job. In 2 weeks, I had a roster of 15 athletes, and I only continued to build that and had a full kind of client base and did mental skill set coaching with youth athletes over 15 different disciplines. And so that to me was coming back to, what was I really good at? I was like a professional teammate. I was an excellent teammate. I knew how to, you know, build systems, build routines, you know, set goals, create best practices, habits, advocate for yourself, communicate with teammates. I knew how to do all of those things. Then eventually moved into the corporate space following that, and now get to do that for companies.
Oh my God. But you just needed to go back to that. What is me?
The gift I have.
What is the gift I have? What is the skill set that I have? How can I honor that?
Yes.
Right? And you had to do it all on your own. You had to build that self-worth internally so you could validate yourself externally.
Yes.
Right? Oh my gosh. But okay, going back to the toxic thoughts, right? You're a strategy builder, right? You overcome stuff.
Yes.
So how can you share those strategies, right? How can you share those strategies that you've built and that you've learned over time to help others overcome perhaps those toxic thoughts that got in your way?
Yeah.
Right?
And what we know is that what we think and what we say to ourselves is really, really powerful because they carve these neural pathways in our brain, and it takes a lot to carve new paths, new positive paths. But I think, you know, in those times where I'm experiencing negative self-talk or self-doubt, there is a lot of focus on, you know, wherever I'm at, there is something that I feel I fell short on. Okay. So what is the learning in that? Can you learn from it? Or are you going to just sit here and spiral and go deeper and deeper and deeper? Like, I'm solution oriented. I am a problem solver. I'm actually very creative at that due to my learning differences. And so, okay, here's the issue. What's the solution? Let's not go down into a deep spiral. So being solution oriented, grace, having self-acceptance and grace in those times is so much easier said than done, but so important. Like, if you can acknowledge what the thing is and then choose to say, it's okay. It's okay. You missed, you know, like 5 shots out of 5 shots. It's okay. Now what's the solution? Let's keep moving forward. There's nothing worse than staying in the same spot. So I think having kind of self-acceptance, having grace, and then finding the solution to your next steps forward. And then finding the people who know you for you and who can hold the mirror up for you when you've lost your way to yourself. Having those good friends that know you well and can remind you sometimes who the heck you are, is really positive, and you'll always come back to you. You're never too far, but sometimes you need a little nudge or reminder.
I love you. I just absolutely love everything that you said. I'm like, that's with you. I like could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. I'm like, I love you.
Oh, thank you.
So we end all of our shows with a little rapid fire question.
Fun.
So super easy, super fun, pretty light, but we might get a little heavy. So my first rapid fire question for you is, how do you start every single day?
With an alarm clock.
Okay, that's a good solution.
How do I start every day? I mean,
do you have a routine?
I do. Like, with a plan is what I was going to say. With a plan. And a plan and preparation. I've got my little outfit set out, you know, the night before, because I'm getting up at 5 o'clock every morning to train. So I've got my lifting outfit out. I've got my water polo bag packed. I've got, you know, my list that needs to be done for work when I come flying in at 9 a.m. and throw that laptop open after training's done. I've got good food prepared and easy to grab. There is a plan. There is a routine. There's not many times that I want to put myself out to dry. Like, I want to show up for myself. So I show up for myself with a plan.
I love that. And then I also want to touch on the point of, I know you are in a relationship, and to have a partner on your side that understands that you need to have that plan, that you need to have, you know, okay, I need to take this amount of time the night before to set up my clothes, to set up for tomorrow.
Yes.
And for them not to, you know, be like, why can't you just chill out and spend time with me, right? That's a whole nother topic of toxic relationships. We'll go there another time.
Yeah.
But I love that.
Yes.
What about, what is your everyday non-negotiable?
Getting outside. Mm-hmm. Getting outside and just, you know, sun or not, just like, get out, get dressed, and get outside. Mm-hmm. Those are the biggest things. You can't hang out, because I work from home. You can't hang out in your pajamas all day, and you can't stay inside all day.
No.
Yeah.
I think that's what kind of harmed people a lot during the pandemic. And I think working remotely kind of harmed some people. I don't know. Maybe it works for some people, but also staying in their pajamas all day long.
No. Nope. Right?
At least
no way.
Change your cool into cool sweats. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So how do you end your day every single day?
Usually in some sort of, How do I end my day? I mean, obviously I've got like a whole like go to bed routine, you know. Ooh,
please share.
I mean, it's nothing. It's what I would say the normal person is, you know. I always shower every night before I go to bed, you know, put on your moisturizers because chlorine is harsh on the skin.
Is it?
But yeah, brush the teeth, make sure all kind of the small checklist is done so you have success for the morning. And yeah, that's it. But I think typically I end my day by touching base with someone I love, whether it's family, my partner, or, you know, friends. I tend to, whether it's a text message or a quick FaceTime or, but it's like, I get to come out of work and I get to like touch base with someone that's just silly fun or just love or someone that I have a good relationship with. I would say for the most part, I like to come out of like the isolation of work and be like, where are my people at? What's up? You know, that's the extrovert me. Yeah.
I want to break free. Yeah. You know that song? What I like to call that is, you'll love this since you like to live a life of joy. I call that kinetic joy.
Yes. Yeah.
Kinetic joy, that spark, like.
Well, and it's funny. Every so often, if I'm working from home and I'm dog tired, I'm like, I'm going to go to a coffee shop. And I say, I'm going to go hijack some energy. I may not even talk to anybody, but just the fact that there's a buzz of energy in the coffee shop, I'm like, I need this today. Thank you. Thank you.
That is great. And I'm going to steal that.
Yeah.
I'm totally going to steal that.
Hijack some energy.
So Cammie, what is one toxic-free, easy habit that people can start doing today?
I think based on our conversation and just kind of the common theme, I would say every morning, a lot of us get ready in the mirror, whether you're brushing your teeth, shaving your face, combing your hair, putting on makeup. And I would say just notice the thoughts that are going through your mind during that time. What are you saying to yourself?
Yes.
You know, what are you saying about your day? Are you even present with yourself? Just notice what's going on with that. And if you're going to be looking at yourself while you're in a towel or perhaps even naked in front of a mirror, talk kindly.
Yeah.
That's your body, your face, your vessel that you get to move through this world in. And just be aware. And if you can take it one step further, talk some kindness at yourself in that mirror.
We all needed to hear that today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Gosh, hold on. Can we see the medals?
Oh, yeah.
Can we totally see the medals? We've got... So our little maven here is...
All right. I'm going to let you...
This is exciting.
Okay.
Should I get on the podium?
Yeah, you totally can. So this is the 2008 Beijing... silver medal that we won. This was my first Olympic Games. I was the young
my nail color.
There you go. I was the youngest on the team at this time, and we were favored for gold and ran into some challenges and ended up losing that game by one, which was probably the most painful loss I have experienced, but absolutely shifted.
Oh,
the jade.
The back.
Yeah.
The back. The jade.
I know, it's pretty awesome. And so it changed everything in how I approached, prepared, and leaned in further for the next two Olympics that I went to. So this is the 2012 London.
I'll switch.
Okay, great.
I don't know if I can hold.
Yes.
They're so heavy.
Oh my gosh, I know. So gold medal from London. This is the first gold medal the women's U.S. water polo program had won in history. So
wow.
Women's water polo debuted in 2000, and we had won silver. 2008, we had won bronze. Or excuse me, 2004, we had won bronze and then silver. And then finally, on the fourth time around at the Olympics, we had won gold.
That is so amazing.
Amazing. So
like that is,
yes.
There's no chocolate in there.
No.
For sure.
Then it's like so nice you want to do it twice, right?
This one's heavier.
In London, we were all kind of looking at our medals in amazement. And my coach was sitting on the like arm of the chair that I was sitting at. And I remember looking at my, it was like, just like this, looking at my medal. And I looked up at him and I was like, do you want to do that? I was like, are you ready to do this again? Essentially, or like, let's do this again. And he was like, could you just enjoy the moment? But it felt so good. But we got to do it again. And so I was veteran on the team in that year with a younger squad, and we were incredibly athletic and talented, and we just crushed. We crushed. If you look back at our scores for the Rio Olympics,
God, this is so stunning.
We did good. So thanks for letting me share. It's always fun to share. You can wear them if you would like.
Oh my God.
Put them all on. Feel the weight.
I would be honored.
They're going to cling a little, which is why they're a little beat up.
Two golds and a silver. This is the best day ever.
It's 12,
thanks, Cammy.
12 years of a lot of water polo.
I'll see you later. I'm going to go get a coffee.
You look legit.
Really?
Yeah.
This is great. I wonder what people would say to me if I walked on the street.
Anyways. Love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Did you see me in those medals? I mean, she actually said that I could take them with me and just like walk around town for the day and just see if like, you know, people were like throwing flowers at me. No, she didn't. I gave them back, I promise. But they looked good, right? So that was a really amazing talk. I'm so thrilled that Cammy was here. But next, let's jump into hot habits, folks. My hot habit for today is taking 3 breaths before meals. You're like, what? Yeah, it was so funny because my husband and I were actually sitting down to dinner one night and I said, stop, wait, hold on, stop before you eat. Huh? He loves when I do that, by the way, especially if he's really hungry. And I was like, just close your eyes, like holding up my bowl of whatever I made and just you know, you get the trend. 3 breaths before meals. Why? Why do I do that? First of all, I run very high energy, as you may or may not be able to tell, and it just gives me a beat to kind of bring me back into that parasympathetic nervous state so I can be calm and so my body can truly rest and digest. The other fun scientific benefit to taking those 3 breaths before meals is that you're actually smelling your food, right? When you smell the food that you're about to ingest, it kind of, this is really great, it starts the salivatory glands and they kind of gets the juices flowing, right? So I like to say it's kind of like foreplay for your dinner time. So that is exactly what I do. Another fun fact about that is amongst lowering cortisol, it may help reduce inflammation. So taking you back into that rest and digestive state so your body can do what it needs to do. So that's my hot habit for today. And then let's flow into trendy trends. Okay, something that's been coming up so much in my life, I feel like it's just being thrown at me, is red light therapy. Raise your hand if you've tried it out there. But red light therapy, I've tried it in senses like saunas, infrared saunas. I've tried it after facials, acupuncture facials. They'll put this red light therapy mask over me. The full body ones, I've gone inside of those, like this little tube thing. I don't know what they're called. I've stood between 2 like platforms, right? You've seen those advertised. But honestly, I'm not sure if I look or if I feel any different. So maybe I need to try them more than one time. But red light therapy, if you don't know anything about it, it's actually a therapeutic technique that uses low level wavelengths of red light. Okay. It's called phototherapy. The benefits that researchers have found out are that it basically treats skin issues. So stretch marks, wrinkles, psoriasis, scars, acne, just to name a few. And it is said to help reduce inflammation, which I know it could be, you know, used more of. Also repairing the muscle tissues. Your girl works out. I work out a lot and I like to work out. And baby, you better believe that I am so sore sometimes. Okay. So repairing muscle tissues, I'd be totally game on board with that. The best takeaway I think I could get from that benefit is that it promotes healthy aging and by restoring the mitochondria. Okay. I'm not going to get all scientific on you right now, but the mitochondria helps with cell reproduction. So if you want healthy aging, you might want to try red light therapy. The one thing that I want to kind of throw at you is there are some risks, right? Because I don't personally believe that there is enough research out there. I don't believe that there are enough clinical trials out there. They have certainly so many years of input and data, but I think there needs to be more research. The global trend for red light therapy, it's so staggering when it comes to the market of just revenue that's coming in from even from 2018, you know, it had, I think, $0.99 billion worth, and it's grown probably $100 million since then. So there is a growth potential. So I want you to be very cautious that you're not just accepting any red light therapy out there, that you know your body very well, and you know if it's helping you or if it's hindering you. So I want to read some studies from the National Institute of Health. In 2018, it was mentioned that red light therapy may help reduce pain. Great, on board with that, totally in on it, okay? But then in 2019, the National Institute of Health said that red light therapy may increase cancer cell aggression and tumor reoccurrences. So I'm not really on board with that. So when in doubt, folks, I'm not a doctor. I just play the part of one. Ask your personal doctor first. All right, guys, thank you so much. I'm so grateful for you always supporting me and tuning in. And remember, you're doing your best and your best is great.